Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, September 9th. The East-West Center begins the semester with 90 new students, even as its future federal funding is uncertain. We hear a call for help to support the new cohort. Why eyebrows are being raised over the retirement of a police officer and the practice of pension spiking. We hear from a New York Times bestselling author from Hawaii about her new book. It's a personal story that takes a look at the life of her late sister. We meet a young shopper who's in school learning lessons about what the past can teach us about the economy. And we explore an annual cultural tradition and go out to experience an Okinawan picnic. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. East-West Center President Celeste Connors is in Washington, D.C., as federal funding for next year is still very much in question. The center says it has heard from the State Department that some $6 million that had been appropriated for this fiscal year will be released sometime in the next 3 weeks. But it's still unclear if the Senate will support the $16 million that the House has put in for next year's budget. But this semester, the center welcomed around 90 new students from 25 countries and territories. The Friends of the East-West Center offers an Ohana program to help share the aloha spirit and connect with the local community. Maura Okamoto stopped by our studios to talk about why building community relationships are so important, particularly during these politically unsettling times, and as the center marks its 65th year.
There was what was called the Ohana program. And part of this, I think, started because of the fact, particularly with Thanksgiving, which is such a big American celebration. These students who have come from overseas, they have no family to go to. And so it was thought, oh, there they are, stuck in the dorms. And so could people take them home for Thanksgiving? So that is one part. It's maybe how it started. But it is not essential that people do this or whatever. But what grew out of it was the idea of trying to match people and that ohana, be family. So these are often graduate students, vary in age, but usually in their 20s. Some have more experience, some are a bit older coming to do graduate work. But it's good to give them that family experience. For some, it may be the first time they've ever been on a plane to come to Hawaii, never mind the other changes. Some are a bit more sophisticated, depending on what countries they come from. But that was the idea, to give them a homey experience. So people get matched and they can do anything from go to the beach, have a picnic, bring them home for dinner, take them to the museum, go to movie, whatever you want to do and whatever people's interests are. That's how it goes.
Yeah, so this is something that really helps to share the aloha because these are really, it's a home away from home for a lot of these students.
Yeah.
And what was your experience?
Well, my husband and I knew someone who did this, Trudy Wong, who was really like one of the big founders of this program, and I knew her personally. And when I find out about it, I said, oh, we'd like to do that. My husband and I met overseas. He was Peace Corps in West Africa, and I was a British volunteer. So we've always had this kind of more international feel. So we have done it now for about 15 years. As part of the Ohana, now both my husband and I are on the board of Friends of East-West Center. But we do have to say it has been a wonderful experience. The students we met, and we are still in touch with almost all of them, they were just interesting people, really lovely. It's hard to put into words, but it is. One of the things, and we didn't do it because of this, but this was a rather lovely bonus that came about. The first one was one of the first students we had, Nabeen, who was from Nepal, 2 years after he'd left, he invited us to his wedding in Nepal. And we went, we said, oh, yes, yes. You know, it's like, how often do you get invited to a wedding? Yeah. And then someone else from Nepal, because we were talking to other students, oh, what do we do? How do we dress? How do we behave? And it's a very big thing and two parts to it. And then she told us, you're invited to that family part. That is so. And they did. His family were wonderful. And he even had a friend who spoke English, and he had her sit with us to help us through it. They are just so lovely. And the thing was, when we started looking into that for the travel, my husband said, oh, look, it's only 45 minutes from Kathmandu to Bhutan. And we had another student for 2 years from Bhutan. So we wrote to him, and he said, come, come. Aww. So we went to Bhutan as part of that trip, which was absolutely fabulous. And the other thing I really like when I travel is I go to see people as opposed to places. Now, if they live in wonderful places, that really is a bonus. Yes. But to be in a country with people who are from there and for them to show you around, it really is different. This is not being a tourist.
Right. Yeah.
And so they take us into their family. The friend in Bhutan, Dorji, he had two children. We'd already met his wife. His wife came, but his children stayed with their grandparents when he was here. And so we got to see them, spend time with them. So it really is a fabulous experience.
Yeah, I had something similar with a Chinese student who was working on his master's and PhD up at the East-West Center. Yeah. And same kind of thing. Stayed with us for a number of years, and we became friends. And then when we went to China, we visited him. And it was just lovely to see his village.
Yeah.
And those connections that you make, those lasting relationships.
Yeah, it is very lasting. Another student who was with us for almost 10 years here, because she did her PhD and pandemic came in the middle. She got married in Japan to a boy from, a man, I should say, young man, from Hawaii, who actually is mixed, part Hawaiian, part Japanese. They are now living in Tokyo. She finished her PhD, but in between got married, had a baby, and is now teaching at a very prestigious university. But she was here last week, and they came for dinner and brought Kai, their little boy, who's now almost four. And we saw him when he was a baby. We are like family.
Yeah, and get back more than you give, really.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
How do people get involved if they are interested in hosting a student for an outing like this?
Yeah. Really, to be linked up, what you should do is go to the website for the Friends of the East-West Center. If you look that up, and then in programs, it will lead you to, there is an application form. And if you fill it in, then hopefully someone will get in touch with you. And then we try and do the matching. And that form asks about interests, other things. And one thing now, we don't always say, but I'd like to stress, because a lot of people are, you know, on their own. People who maybe don't have a partner or whatever, that sometimes maybe with another friend, that some people think, oh, I can't do that. It's a burden. But do you have another friend? And you and your friend maybe take a student to the museum or something like that. And one of the things I think we are looking at now is to try and also promote bringing small groups together so that it's like a little bit extended family. So maybe a couple of people who are matched with students get together and occasionally do maybe a bigger potluck kind of thing.
Just with aunties and uncles.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it is. It is. And I have to tell you, we have been so lucky. So many of our students cook. So they come and cook. And going shopping with a student from Vietnam, going to the farmer's market and her telling me what everything was. And then we buy it, bring it home, and we cook together. That was fabulous.
Yeah, I just know that when my daughter had a friend who was an exchange student at McKinley High School, he was from France. And when she was over there doing a study abroad, she made a point to
go visit him. And he was so touched that someone from so far away would make an effort to reconnect. And it does mean the world to them.
Oh,
you know. All right. So the Ohana program of Friends of the East-West Center. So if our listeners would like to learn more, they can go to the website.
Yes. That is wonderful. Thank you so much for giving us this chance to talk about this wonderful program.
All right. Thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you.
That was Mara Okamoto of the Friends of the East-West Center talking about the Ohana program, which this year supports some 300 students here in Hawaii. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the City and County of Honolulu's Resilience Office. Everyone is vulnerable to health risks from hot weather, but some are more at risk. Learn more at keepcooloahu.gov.
Illicit drugs like fentanyl and methamphetamine are dangerous, and not just for the people who use them. Their production impacts the environment as well. We take you to the Mexican state of Sinaloa, where secret drug labs are dumping chemical waste into local streams, posing health risks to nearby communities. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This morning, the lead story for Honolulu Civil Beat has to do with the retirement of a Honolulu police officer who's been in the news before. Reporters Madeline Valera and Caitlin Thompson collaborated on the piece. And this morning, Caitlin joins us to talk about the latest developments. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. And, you know, this officer, he's been with the department for, gosh, almost 3 decades.
Yeah, this is a name that's going to be pretty familiar to people who've been paying close attention to the Honolulu Police Department. This is Darren Cotola. He joined the HPD forces in the mid-1990s, and he's had quite the history with the department. And that's there's a whole timeline that we can talk about. But the most recent development, he just retired in August, at the beginning of August. After, almost 3 decades with the force.
Yeah, and your article shows a flyer that he posted for his retirement party, which was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the flyer shows Darren Cotola with George Zimmerman, who killed an unarmed young black man, Trayvon Martin, and also with the Minneapolis police officer who was charged with the death of George Floyd. It's a pretty interesting flyer.
Yeah, so he has retired, but the thing that's caught people's attention is his retirement pay.
Yeah, so he retired at the end of August, or at the beginning of August, and he is leaving the force with quite a bit of money in his pension. So prior to the way the pensions are calculated is a little bit interesting, particularly for government employees who were hired before 2012. Before 2012, or if they were hired before 2012, which Darren Cotola was, overtime counts towards their pension. And in the last 3 years of his time on the force, my colleague, Madeline Valera, discovered that he, in some public records and some data, discovered that he had really increased the number of hours of overtime that he was working that were going to count towards his pension. So in the last year that he spent on the force, he earned over 1,000 hours in overtime, what that actually comes down to is an extra 45 hours a week, every single week of the last officer or of the last year that he was an officer on the force. And that puts his pension at more than $200,000 a year for the rest of his retirement. And a quick comparison that I found really interesting, former chief of the Honolulu Police Department, Joe Logan, earned $230,000. Mayor Rick Blangiardi earns about $210,000. Darren Cotola is leaving the force with, you know, the potential that taxpayers could be paying more than $200,000 in his pension for the rest of his retirement.
Yeah, and we've learned that interim police chief Roddy Vanek is looking into this retirement just to make sure that, you know, it was properly logged mm-hmm. and authorized.
Yeah. Yeah, Chief Vanek has said that they're looking into it. He said, you know, extreme high numbers of overtime hours are rare. But, you know, this is a something that Civil Beat has looked into in the past regarding people who are essentially spiking their pensions by using overtime to calculate towards that that total.
Right. And that spiking, I know there's something that the lawmakers tried to tighten up, but it appears that he is eligible for this. Now they just have to verify that he worked those hours.
Exactly. Exactly. And the reason that Darren Cotola is going to be a familiar name for people is because of his past. So in 2014, video came out of him hitting his then girlfriend at a restaurant. And this, you know, made the news. It led to calls from the mayor to look into both him and the responding officers. He's had several allegations of abuse. In 2019, he was charged with abuse of his ex-wife. Those charges were later dropped after she stopped cooperating with the prosecution. But his ex-wife sued the department and Sergeant Cotola, and that resulted in a $320,000 settlement from the city. And, you know, end of 2015, he was actually fired from the force. He challenged that, and an arbitrator ordered for him to be reinstated, and he was reinstated several years later in February of 2018.
Yeah, so he's got a bit of a checkered past, but now we'll mm-hmm. just see what happens with this investigation with the current chief. But thank you so much, Caitlin, for flagging this.
Thank you so much.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Caitlin Thompson. You can read more at civilbeat.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Calling all gardeners, today's backyard quiz takes us outside into the dirt. Each pair recently stopped by a release day for a new variety of a plant. Close to 100 people picked up samples of this veggie from the University of Hawaii College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resilience. What made this batch of crops different was that these mild-tasting vegetables don't just grow from seed. They can reproduce by splitting from the stem. According to Associate Extension Agent Joshua Silva, this variety was recently rediscovered after 20 years in storage.
At least for the home growers, it's perfect because it's, you know, the right size, grows quickly, and you can cut and harvest from the same plant, you know, a couple of times, just enough for your pokés, your simons, those kind of things that home growers and home foodies like to do.
So for today's quiz, we want to know, what veggie could he be talking about? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag. You'll also receive a deck of the card game Kumulaau, courtesy of Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Rebecca Sue, A Sister's Reflections on Disability, Faith, and Love is the title of the latest book by bestselling author Kathleen Norris. Norris attended Punahou and has written several books. It's her first story about Hawaii, which details life with her disabled sister, Becky. Norris's little sister told her to write about her life, and Becky died a few years ago, but she lives on in Rebecca Sue. Here's Norris.
She was born in 1952. And my parents were both early childhood educators, and they knew she wasn't developing the way I did, my brother did. Like, Becky never learned to crawl. That was physically just, she required too much coordination. So they knew things were off. But what Becky did instead, and this was typical of her, she developed the ability to scoot around the house on her butt, just faster than a little rocket. And she had this little piece of blanket that she called her mine. So she got everywhere she wanted to go. It's just she didn't do it the right way, the normal way. And that kind of defines her in a way. But my parents recognized something was wrong. And they later learned it was called perinatal hypoxia, which means at some point in the birth canal, you didn't get enough oxygen and it killed some brain cells. And the really hard thing for my sister was that she was intelligent enough to know that this had happened to her. So she bore this burden of resentment and anger that really never left her. At some parts of her life, it was more pronounced. By the time she died, she was much more at peace with the world and with everybody. But that was a burden to live with.
I just think because you describe in your book, you know, being at the hospital and all the equipment that she's hooked up to. And that brought back some of my memories because I think there's an excerpt in your book where you think the doctor said, it's not cancer. And that was my experience, was both my parents died of cancer. And so it was around hospitals a lot. And you just, when you live it like that, it just brings back a flood of memories.
Yeah. And I mean, I have, you know, one of the unique things for me is that this is my first of my books that's set in Honolulu, because Becky lived here from the time we moved here in 1959 when she was seven. And she lived here the rest of her life. And she was at Queens Hospital quite a bit for all kinds of reasons, mental and physical ailments and stuff in the emergency room and this and that. And then Kakuakalihi Valley was where she got her main medical care. They were absolutely wonderful. The physicians, the counselors, and the psychiatrists she had there really made a huge difference in her life. So all of these places kind of figure in this book because they were a big part of her life. And Becky would often ask me if she was going to see her counselor, come out with me, we can talk together, which was very helpful. And the amazing thing about this book to me is that Kakuakalihi Valley gave me access to her complete medical records after she died. So I could take all kinds of notes and realize I knew my sister had a lot of physical problems, but I had no idea how serious they were until I read the doctor's emergency room notes from Queens. Wow. Just wow. She really had even more burdens than I was aware of. So anyway, this book is unique, but as you said, it really is more personal in a way than my other books because it's about my family. It's about growing up with this sister who was difficult, but had a really strong personality, real character, and trying to sort all that out. I've wanted to write this book for many years, and sometimes it feels a little like a miracle that it finally came to pass. An early draft was rejected by people I'd worked with for years. It was a real shock. And of course, as a writer, you get used to rejection, but that really was difficult. So it sat on a shelf for a long time, and I finally said, no, I'm too old to wait around. I'm going to get this, see if I can finish this and find a publisher for it.
Sometimes, though, the things that are so close to you and so intimate
It's hard because you put your heart and soul right there on paper.
Oh, yeah. Lots of times with this book and my other ones, too. Do I really have to tell this story about myself? Do I really have to admit to this? But you do. You do. And Becky, there were so many stories that she loved to tell on herself. One of them's in the book. It's one of my favorite encounters. When I was 14, we lived in Navy housing out by Pearl Harbor, and they had cinder block walls. And I got my first lipstick, and it was this hideous shade of coral, but I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And Becky was too young for lipstick, and she was very jealous. So one day I found her writing on our cinder block wall with my lipstick. And of course, I was furious. I yelled at her, and she just turned and looked at me and said, "You can't hit me. I'm retarded."
Wow.
So that was her. She could take advantage of her disability when it worked for her. And Becky loved to tell that story on herself later on, that "You can't hit me. I'm retarded." That was her.
Well, you know, I think relationships can be very complicated when you have someone in the family with special needs, just because they do have everybody's attention because of their disability. But it is amazing, like you shared the story about her scooting. She finds a way, right? Can't crawl, but you'll find another way.
Yeah, she did. She did a lot of that in her life. And we used to joke about all the things we shared because we're both terrible at math. Becky really had no idea about numbers. I probably have about a sixth grade idea of numbers. But if you gave her a dollar bill or a $20 bill, she wouldn't know what the difference was. 1 and 20, what is that? She really had none of that. But we used to tease each other about our math anxiety. Neither one of us like elevators or big crowds. And Becky used to love to talk about how alike we were in many ways. And we were. And I've long been convinced, because Becky wrote wonderful letters, and I quote a number of them in the book. She had a great way of expressing herself. And I said, I think she was meant to be the writer in this family. I really had that feeling for years. And I'm happy now, grateful that I was able to do this book and quote so many of the things she said and wrote, because she really was a good writer. And you hear someone's disabled or brain damage or something, you might not expect that from them. But Becky, her personality shines through, her honesty and her reaction. She didn't have the kind of filters that people usually have, most adults develop. And Becky was just brutally honest, and it would take people aback. But if you knew her, you just said, "Oh, that's Becky." One time I was trying to tell her something that had happened to me, a really important story, and she just stopped me. "No, I go first. My story is more important than yours." And that's in the book. And that's, I knew not to laugh. But I thought, wow, a lot of people feel that way, but Becky's the one who will just come right out and say it.
You write in your book, too, when you wrote, I think, your first novel, and it was a bestseller on the New York Times list, and she resented that.
She did. Well, she had a lot of jealousy, I think, especially of me, and her letter about that book was just priceless. I still have the original someplace. I read your book and it was boring and everybody's talking about it and I can't understand why, but I really love you and I'm crying while I write this. It was all these emotions just right out there on the page. It's probably the best letter about any book that I ever got because it was so honest. And yeah, and there were times, there's an incident in the book when Becky was seriously ill. She was in an ICU and I had been kind of acting as the liaison to inform my parents because they were close to 80 at that point, I think, telling them what was going on with her, going to the hospital, finding out stuff. And the nurse he said, "I don't think you should go in there because the last time you visited, she got very upset, as if I'd been abusive or something." And I went, "Oh, wow, wow." And I said, "No," I said, "I'll just leave. I brought her a teddy bear. I'll just leave it. You can take it in." I wasn't going to go in if she was that way, resentful, or if it would upset her. But that really took me aback, that when she was at her worst, she really didn't want to see me. And I thought, wow, that's hard. And I understood it. And then when she got out of the ICU, it was like, can you take me to the movies again? She was back to normal. Yeah. But there was that moment there that I thought, wow. And that I had to write about that in the book. That was one of the harder things to experience, but it was hard to write about it as well.
I'm sure it was difficult, too, when you lost her.
Yeah. And it was, we knew it was coming. Becky, it was incredible. She had breast cancer 10 years before and had survived it. She really came through treatment very well, and I was with her a lot when that was going on. Her wonderful doctor at the Kalihi Valley Center to Kapi'olani, the women's center there, it was just fantastic. And she came through that, but then she developed esophageal cancer 10 years later, and the doctor said, this is not related. This is a whole different cancer. So she ended up getting cancer twice, and again, she got wonderful treatment at the Queen's Cancer Center and really liked the staff there. And they had a great therapy dog named Yoda who was just wonderful. And all of that was really good. But I began to think maybe this is probably not going to end well. This is probably going to be it. So I was resolved that was going on, although initial treatment and everything seemed to work out very well. And then all of a sudden, it had metastasized. Yeah. And so that was it. And she died. And she was, I was so proud of her that day that we found out that the cancer was no longer treatable. And both of us knew what that meant. And the doctor was very sweet, very compassionate to both of us. But he said, do you want a prognosis? And Becky said, what's that? Because she had a pretty good vocabulary to keep up with the family. But she didn't know what that word meant. And he said, it's our guess as to how much longer you have to live. And she said, no way. No mm-hmm. way. And I thought, so Becky, I am proud of you. I told her. I said, that is a really good idea because now you can just live your life and you don't have to worry about when it's going to end. And that's what happened. But she died that was in February and she died in April. So she really didn't have very long.
What is it that you hope that readers will take away when they read the story of Rebecca Sue?
Well, I think it's so tempting not to see disabled people as full people. It's so common when you hear someone has a disability that you see them as a little less and you don't really expect much of them. And especially if they're in a wheelchair, you would talk to the person steering the wheelchair, not to them, those kinds of things. And what I would hope that readers would come away from this book understand that feeling like they've met a real person, a full person in my sister. Because she really had a dynamic personality. And also the transformation that she went through towards the end of her life, where she had been quite kind of self-centered, I think, in defense of, because she'd been told she was stupid and retarded and all these things most of her life, she developed a kind of shell around herself, very, very self-absorbed and narcissistic. And that just evaporated. It went away in the last 5 years or so of her life, and she became more genuinely interested in other people, including the nurses at the cancer center. And they're so used to people who are afraid and angry, and Becky just, they all loved her there because she would engage them in conversations about their families and their kids. And just really, she had such an amazing personality. So I think it's so easy to discount disabled people. So I hope this book will help to people say, no, here's a real person. This is the person you might want to know about.
Yeah, I think of that line, children of a lesser God.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, to really think about that and see the whole person and see what they have to offer and what they can teach us.
Yeah. And I think people who work with the disabled really do understand that. In fact, one of the sweet things in my family, my dad was a Navy musician. He was the bandmaster at Pearl Harbor. That's why we came out here in the first place, to the territory of Hawaii. But when he retired from the Navy, because of my sister, he went to the UH and got a degree and taught special ed in the schools here. And boy, did he understand that these were full people, even the ones who had some pretty serious disabilities. And I learned a lot from him about that. And I think his spirit kind of helped me write this book, because presenting Becky as this interesting person and a full person.
All right. Rebecca Sue is the title. Kathleen Norris, thank you so much for sharing her story.
Thank you.
Again, the book is Rebecca Sue, and it is out this month. Look for author Kathleen Norris at a book signing and talk October 5th at St. Andrew's Cathedral at 2 p.m. in the Von Holt Room. And we also learned that books will be available at Barnes & Noble Bookstore after September 19th. Time now for another installment of What's in Your Cart? The conversation. C.W. Gibson recently went to Walmart in Honolulu and met Sam, a 19-year-old who lives near the Alawai Canal.
Sam talked about the products that he's noticed have become more expensive and how his schooling affects his outlook on the economy.
I got some corned beef, eggs, some Jell-O, just stuff for the house, for the roommates too. You know, I got the shopping list for a bunch of people, so.
Are you regularly shopping for the roommates?
Yeah, sometimes. We take turns, you know.
Do you always do the shopping here?
Yes, or Costco. You know, Costco here, you know, you gotta go to Costco if you want to survive.
So are there items that you bought today that you buy on a regular basis or your roommates buy on a regular basis that you've noticed the prices have changed a lot in the last few months?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, eggs and a bunch of that stuff. Anything fresh, though. I didn't actually get a lot of fresh things today. Usually these past few weeks, I've noticed, you know, a few things going up, especially here. Not at Costco so much, but definitely at Walmart.
So Costco feels more stable, but Walmart and sort of general grocery stores seem like they fluctuate a little bit more.
Yes, especially fresh items for sure.
Yeah, produce and vegetables.
Yeah. Thankfully, today wasn't a whole lot of that.
How are you feeling about the economy in general? Are you in the working world? Are you a student?
Yes, both. I work. I'm a student also. Yeah, things kind of suck right now. it's a little pricey, but you know.
What are you studying?
I'm doing finance. Finance. I'm on my first year, so you know. But yeah, kind of tough out here sometimes. You know.
Does all the talk about the economy and tariffs, inflation, does any of that like affect your interest in finance, or did any of that drive your interest in finance?
No, if anything, it makes me want to understand it more. You know, I think like seeing how that works, those behind the scenes. I also think, you know, it gives me some peace of mind knowing that, you know, there's always some talk about things being wrong and everything being bad and everything being expensive. So, you know, yeah, it's a pretty cool topic.
I think that's a great point, because it might sound a little strange or backwards, but when you can hear horrible stories from the past, it makes you realize it's not the first time.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of how I feel about it.
And have you made any changes to how you approach shopping or how you're approaching your budgeting because of economic forces?
Well, I try not to. If I'm going to make any cuts, I'll probably cut off things outside of my shopping, because I'll try to eat healthy and stuff like that. So maybe maybe one less coffee a week, stuff like that, you know, and keep the groceries the same, hopefully, yeah.
Or even make your own coffee, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Imagine that.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
That was Sam from Honolulu talking to HBR's D.W. Gibson about looking to the past to make sense of today's economy. Where do you think we should go next? Leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters 15th Anniversary Celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
Hawaii Public Radio brings you moments of serendipity. Ever have a driveway moment because you just had to know how that story ended? Or stumble upon an incredible piece of music from one of our hosts? Now's the chance to support that serendipity, because HPR is powered by you. Donate $10 a month at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting saxophonist and composer Boney James, performing songs from his new album Slow Burn, September 13th and 14th, in two sets nightly. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Now it's time to wash off the dirt and harvest the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the release of a new variety of a popular vegetable. Extension agents from the University of Hawaii, CTAR, the UH College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resilience, recently handed out these crops to 100 people. Lon's took home a bunch of these veggies and brings us today's answer.
As far as like harvesting the onions, it's something that you can't really get easily. It's going to grow really well in your yard. It's not something made commercially. Also, like with the garden community, we always share. So like, you know, I have a bunch here that I plan on sharing with people who are interested in growing, you know. So, I mean, it's something you can easily grow at home. And I'm sorry, but vegetables, herbs, they're all expensive nowadays, you know. And also, I like to bring my child so he can learn some things, you know, get dirty a little.
And if you didn't catch it, the answer we were looking for was green onions. And thanks to HBR reporter Mark Liddell for capturing the release of these veggies. And congrats to Cindy from IAEA. She's a horticulturalist, and she says winning the quiz made her day. All right, Cindy, go out and celebrate with some green onions. But that's our quiz today. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This year marks 125 years since the first record of Okinawan immigration in Hawaii, and celebrations are taking place throughout the year to commemorate the first generation of immigrants known as the Issei. But no celebration was as beloved to our summer intern as the annual tradition of the club picnic. HBR's Laura Dukes attended a picnic earlier this summer and brings us the story about a celebration of Okinawan immigration that's been happening for decades.
Watch your step for the vegetables. Some of them are blending into the ground. Okay, you can get anything that you can.
On the grass of Ala Moana Beach Park in Honolulu, kids take home composition books for winning a three-legged race. My aunties fight for the biggest carrot during the veggie circle game. And before she passed, my great-grandma danced the kashashi, an Okinawan folk dance to musical chairs. My mom called this day the Okinawan Picnic. I went every summer as a kid. I didn't know anyone else who went to them. I thought it was just our thing. I live in Los Angeles now, and surprisingly, I'm surrounded by so many things that remind me of Hawaii. Streets fill with communities who immigrated here for a better life. Bougainvillea bushes that are not native to LA or Hawaii, but grow abundantly in both places. Sometimes, a street corner in the sprawling city can trick me into thinking I'm in Honolulu. I don't know if that says more about Hawaii than LA. But something I didn't expect in LA was an invitation to an Okinawan picnic. Turns out these picnics weren't just for my family. So many people have their own picnic memories.
My name is Esther Kanashiro Matsubara. I now live in Rancho Palos Verdes, California. I was born on Maui on a sugarcane plantation. Going to the picnic was the highlights of our life. I can't really remember from the very beginning, but I'm sure I was at a picnic when I was a toddler. But every year we look forward to it and look forward to all the games that we're going to play.
My name is Yuki Kikuyama. I'm here in Little Ferry, New Jersey, which is like about 15 to 20 minutes from New York City. And I am a part of OANI, which is the Okinawan American Association of New York. One of my favorite things about the picnics growing up would be like the amount of people. What I remember from the picnic is like the suikawaris, like mashing of the watermelons, the tug of war, and just like the amount of music that would be played.
I'm Phoenix. I'm from Santa Monica and Gardena. My favorite thing about the picnic is the blend dancing at the end because everyone always joins in together and it's always really nice just seeing everyone dancing together.
My picnic was an Okinawan picnic, but its real name is the Nishihara Chojinkai Picnic, named after the town, Nishihara, my family emigrated from more than 100 years ago.
Okay, here we go.
I went back to the picnic as an adult for the first time this summer. A few things have changed. We're closer to the beach this year. But otherwise, it's pretty much exactly as I remembered it. Even the winning flags look like they've never been replaced. Each one, some worn and fraying. A hand-sewn fabric number on a wooden stick. I find Emma Sadaoka at the game finish line. She just got her prize of a cereal box and a plastic bowl.
My name's Emma, and I'm 9 years old.
And what's your favorite game at the picnic?
I think it's the the one that you put the get the golf ball and put on the spoon and you walk down and back. I think it's the most funnest one.
Okinawan immigrant communities all over the world have held their own summer picnics for decades. But the clubs that put on these gatherings weren't founded on fun and games.
Plantation life was incredibly difficult. So this provided a way of creating fellowship, social, and potentially economic support.
That's Kelly Nakamura. She's a history professor at Kapi'olani Community College. Nakamura says these clubs started as a way to provide mutual aid. We call these communities clubs in Hawaii, but they're also known as kenjinkais.
We see the beginnings of kenjinkai coming out of this idea of mutual aid and fellowship. We see them still continuing through the late 19th through the 20th century and even now still today.
The Okinawan Issei, the first generation of immigrants, came to Hawaii in 1900. What started with a small group of 26 men grew to more than 25,000 Okinawans by the mid-1920s, thanks to a booming sugar and pineapple plantation industry. Hawaii's kenjinkais were created by the people who emigrated from the same villages in Okinawa. Because they couldn't get typical support from a bank or extended family, these groups would loan money out to each other, fundraise, and just look out for one another. No one I asked knew exactly when these picnic traditions began, but the leaders I spoke with had a pretty good idea of why they were started.
My guess would be just to get the membership together to be able to make those announcements and to collect dues.
Bob Shiroma is the president-elect for the Hawaii United Okinawan Association. The association was created back in the 50s, when a small group of clubs banded together to help with the post-war efforts in Okinawa. Okinawa was in ruins after World War II. It's estimated that one-third of the population died during this time. Hawaii Okinawans used the clubs they had built for one another to give back. They sent clothes, school supplies, and even 500 pigs to repopulate what was lost on the islands. While the association organizes the annual Okinawa Festival, the smaller clubs that predate them are best known for the summer picnics. I asked Bob why the tradition has stayed alive. Why do you think picnics still happen today, and why do you think they're important?
To me, they're important for the older folks that have ties to when club picnics first started. Sad to say, you know, time takes its toll, so less and less of the older people. And I woke up one day and I became one of those older people, so the older generation. So, yeah, so the Issei are passing away, but I'm sure it was for them to get together because they had the struggles of starting anew in a foreign land. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot to be thankful for them.
Okinawans in Hawaii are celebrating 125 years of immigration this year. But this milestone also means the community is now a mix of fourth, fifth, and even sixth generation immigrants. With each generation comes a new realization that traditions like the annual picnic are slowly fading away.
A lot of the clubs are struggling to not only keep their membership going, but to find new leadership. That's one of the main objectives of the strategic plan: recruit, develop, and maintain membership as well as future leaders for the Hawaii United Okinawan Association. Yeah. There's so much competition for time and commitment.
What Shiroma is saying is that people don't need the support from the clubs the same way the Issei did. They aren't denied a bank loan because of their race. And the picnic isn't the only time they'll see friends and relatives. Even Kelly Nakamura, who teaches this history and went to club events as a child, hasn't taken her daughter to a single picnic. She says there are too many soccer games and piano lessons.
I wish my 8-year-old daughter would be able to experience one of those kinds of events. There's kind of this universal childhood experience that many people fondly reminisce about. Some people still have that wonderful experience of being able to, you know, participate in those things. And I think that's absolutely wonderful, and that's great. And we pass that tradition of providing assistance, support, and community to the next generation. I think that's kind of the critical part. It's less the material goods and, you know, the physical act of gathering, but just this recognition of I'm here for you and I'm willing to help out.
Clifford and Sherry Goya, Garrett and Nadine Goya, thank you so much.
Club membership is on the decline. I saw it at my own picnic this year when the Nishihara Chonjinkai merged with another club, Gaza Yonaguskus Doshikai, to keep the picnic going. Lisa Sadaoka is from the Gaza Club. She talked about why she brought her kids to the picnic.
It's so nice to just instill the family values. Like, my kids understand that we are one family, and they feel like the sense of belonging to not only our family, but to the club as well. They're very aware of where our family comes from in Okinawa, and that makes me happy just to know that that part of our culture is, you know, being carried on. And it's because of traditions like this that it makes it easy to pass on those things, you know, to the next generation. So I'm very grateful, even more so as an adult now, for events like this.
I find Clifford Goya under the club check-in tent. His grandfather revitalized the Nishihara Club after the war. Now his kids are the club's presidents.
It's like a tradition, right? My grandfather was a president, my father, and then myself. And then so I wanted my kids to, you know, share the experience, I guess. Usually the Okinawan community is real close. They stick together, help each other out.
Okay, so we are going to start with the vegetable circle, and this will only be for the older
voters. The game I remember most is the one you heard earlier. Goya's daughter warned participants to watch their step for low-lying bitter melon. It's where everyone gathers around a rope circle and picks up as many fruits and vegetables as they can carry with their hands. It's a crowd favorite because, well, you get a lot of free vegetables. But Goya says that's just one point of the game.
You can see across the ring or the circle and see, you know, people you never saw before and kind of have something in common with. So it's a way to get people together. Not really winning the prize, but, you know, picking up the vegetables, but, you know. And it's to sustaining them, feeding them, right? You know, taking home some food for feed the whole family kind of deal. So it's all that kind of meaning to this thing right now, I think, you know.
Mutual aid. Like what Kelly Nakamura said was the club's purpose back in the plantation era. I grew up calling it the Okinawan Picnic. But when I was doing research for this story, I looked up its real name, Nishihara Chojinkai. That's when I found an entry my great-grandfather wrote. He passed away 20 years ago, when I was still a kid and didn't know the name of our club. But here, on a very outdated part of the Hawaii Okinawan Association's website, is a short piece of writing that feels like it's just for me. My great-grandfather, telling me where we came from, what the Issei did, and how the club supported Okinawa after the war. People have different ideas for what the picnics are. They can be a day for playing games, or honoring the Issei, or just keeping a tradition alive for tradition's sake. But at their core, they're a memory of celebrating what it took to get here. Generations later, we're still looking out for each other.
And that was our super summer intern, Laura Dukes. She produced this story about the annual tradition of the Okinawan summer picnic. You can head to our website after today's show to see photos from her story, including the veggie circle game. Well, we're out of time, so that wraps it up for us today. Tomorrow, we take a closer look at the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. We hear from a group that sued ICE for hard numbers on arrests and detentions. Share your comments or questions about what you heard by calling our talkback line, that number, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.